Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle.
I'm sorry for the lonely times I wasn't even there. With my thimble full of whiskey and my pocket.
While covering the Bristol Rhythm and Roots Music Festival in Bristol, Virginia, I had the absolute pleasure to visit with musician and songwriter Roseanne Cash. In addition to being an ardent fan of Roseanne's music, I also adore her as a most kind, gracious, and compassionate human being. When I first interviewed her years ago at the Johnny Cash Music Festival at the University of Arkansas in Jonesboro, I came away touched by her thoughtfulness, kindness, and skill at being totally focused and in the moment. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join the conversation as Roseanne waxes poetically about her life journey and passion for making the world a better place, along with a most humble awareness of the preciousness of life. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Chatter so I can get a level here.
That background noise isn't going to bother you?
It's okay. We're on location.
Yeah, you're on location.
Actually, in radio, I like having that sense of being wherever you are.
Wherever you are, yeah. That, instead of a box.
Yeah,
right?
They try and bring you in the office. I go, no, let's go outside. So here we are, Roseanne Cash. How cool.
We'll see about that.
No, I already know. So here we are in Bristol, the birthplace of American roots music.
It's pretty powerful to be here. Like I just said to someone, I feel embarrassed that I haven't really spent any time here before, only passed through, because it figures so prominently, not just in American cultural history, but in my own ancestry.
Yeah,
my family.
1927 Bristol Sessions.
Well, not only that, Tom, but the Cash family settled in Westmoreland County, Virginia in the 18th century, and then were in part of the branch, including my dad, moved to Tennessee. My stepmother, June, and her family, obviously you know that history, right here in Bristol in Virginia, and then on to Tennessee. So Virginia and Tennessee are like part of my bloodstream. It feels like home to be down here.
Yeah. When you were a kid, where did you live?
I was born in Memphis.
Okay.
Grew up in Southern California. Moved back to Nashville, and then I've lived in New York City for 30 years. I married a native New Yorker.
There you go. So when you were a teenager, when did that heartstring of music and writing music hit you? Or was it always there?
Always. I think from infancy, you know, the rhythms just, rhythms were part of my cellular makeup. And then I started writing poetry when I was 8, 9 years old, won a poetry contest when I was 9, always loved language and putting words together, and then eventually that became songwriting. So that's how I started, is songwriting.
Interesting. So when you are writing, are you ultimately writing for yourself therapeutically in a way?
That's an interesting question. I think that an outcome of songwriting can often be therapeutic, but I think if you approach real disciplined songwriting as a craft and as an art to do it as therapy, I don't know if that is the most noble goal for it. I think songwriting is a pure art, and of course you start with your own life because you know, or
it's what you know.
It's what you know, or your observations, it's what you know. And oftentimes it can be very cathartic and very therapeutic, but I resist it being as therapy.
Sure.
Yeah.
It might be a bonus.
There you go.
Yeah. And when did you pick up the guitar, and was it to accent your storytelling?
Well, you would think that because of my dad, I would have picked up the guitar when I was, you know, preteen.
Right.
I didn't.
I
started playing piano. So who taught me guitar is the Carter women.
Oh, wow.
I was on the road with my dad and the Carter family at 18 years old, and I spent a lot of time in the dressing room with the Carter women, and Helen and Anita and June and Maybelle just spent time with me, and the first things I learned on guitar were those Carter family songs. I owe those women a tremendous debt.
That's so cool.
I'm going to play one of them tonight, in fact.
I'll be there.
Yeah.
So your dad.
Yeah.
You know, it's my dad, you know, he's cast a big shadow. And so it can be intimidating sometimes. You know, how do you get out from under that shadow?
I don't know that I ever entirely will or have gotten out from that. But the key is not to struggle against it. The key is to know who you are and let the shadow be nourishing.
An inspiration.
An inspiration. And my legacy, you know, not to push it away. I'm too old to push away a legacy as important as that.
Yeah.
And I've come to honor my parents, and they were certainly not perfect, but to be able to appreciate what they gave me and be grateful for that, I mean, that's grace, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Growing up in the midst of it, were you too close to realize the fame and fortune? Because it was like, this is my family.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. It took me a long time to realize that we were abnormal. And the greatest thing, my son, when he was about, because, you know, I live a public life too, and my husband, and we are public figures as well, and then my family, and my son, when he's about 9 or 10 years old, he suddenly said at the dinner table, he said, "I'm not having a normal childhood." And my husband said, "Son, compared to mom."
That's funny. So you live in New York.
Yeah.
When you walk around, you go to the store. Are you
anonymous?
Do you have some anonymity?
Absolutely. I mean, people in New York, they're very cool. If they recognize you, they just kind of nod or say, you know, "I saw you on Letterman last night," or something like that. And as a writer who wants to be anonymous in order to observe and allow things to inspire me like that, that's one of the reasons I love living in New York so much. Also, the constant stimulation. I'm just that kind of person. I'm kind of an intense person, and I like stimulation.
Counterpoint accent.
There you go.
Yeah. So today, what is closest to your heart? What are you trying to communicate, to share? Is there a mission?
A mission. That might be too grand a notion, but there is definitely an urgency in my mind and my heart and my spirit these days, and I think it has to do with mortality and knowing that time is the most precious thing, and there are still things I want to do with my life. I know why I'm on the planet, and I want to write more, I want to share more, I want to become better at what I do. I mean, I want to leave a ripple of goodness in the world, if that's possible.
Yeah.
I mean, every bit counts, doesn't it?
So a while back, you had a brain tumor.
It was a brain condition. It was an abnormality in my brain.
I love that. Was it the New York Times article?
Yes. Oh, I wrote an article so that said, well, actually, it is brain surgery.
I love that. But nonetheless, that moment, it must have been a reality, a mortality wake-up call.
Oh, yeah.
So a game shifter for you. Huh?
Totally was. And while I was recovering from the surgery, which was quite brutal, I spent a lot of time thinking about that. What do I want to do with the time I have left on
Earth?
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's, I call it the humbleness of soul. You know, ultimately we wake up dead one day.
That's right. So I read something very interesting just yesterday. They said, it was the poet John Donne from the 16th or 17th century. And, you know, Newgate Prison in England and Tyburn was where they executed it. And he said, "Does the prisoner stay asleep from Newgate to Tyburn?" So we should not stay asleep from birth to death. We should try to be awake in every moment.
I love it. Unfortunately, I'm getting the...
A signal?
The producer. with the little hook. Thank you, Roseanne.
My pleasure.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We've been talking with Roseanne Cash in Bristol, Tennessee, and Virginia.
A man can work his whole life through and never think to change or fret about the feels like a new goodbye. Every day feels like a new goodbye.
dinner and children. Oh yes, didn't it? You know, didn't it? Oh, Mallow, didn't it rain?
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
My name is Jake Blunt. I am from Providence, Rhode Island.
Tell me about your music.
I perform traditional black folk music. Sometimes that means I'm playing bluegrass and old time stuff with a string band. Sometimes it means I'm doing a little bit of a different thing. But we're excited to be bringing both sounds to Bristol this week.
In your cultural nuances, do you go back to the roots of African-American music?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mostly I learned my music off of field recordings from the early to mid-1900s, traditional stuff like that.
So Carolina Coffee.
Chocolate Drops, yeah. Yes, yeah. They're good friends of mine.
I love their music.
Me too, that's what got me into this.
Really?
Yeah. When I was first starting to learn to play this music, I spent a week with Rhiannon Giddens and Hubby Jenkins up at the Augusta Heritage Center in Elkins, West Virginia, and that was really what got me started.
And for me, the banjo that they...
Yeah,
it's like, wow, bring me home.
Yes.
How about going back the roots of African-American music, going back to Africa? Have you done that?
Yes, I have been a little bit unsure how to approach going all the way back to the continent because I don't think, you know, I'm from America. Right. I know how to do the music we have here. Yeah, I would love to collaborate with someone at some point. But on my own, I'm working on a new project now called The New Faith, or I finished it on Smithsonian Folkways Recordings as part of their African American Legacy series. It's an Afrofuturist work, so it takes all of these old songs that I've been listening to, imagines them several hundred years in the future after the changes of the climate crisis have taken place, and draws off stuff from like 1688.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So is there a dystopian element there?
I don't like to call it that. Mm. I think dystopia implies too much structure.
Okay.
But we're not in a happy place.
So there's a metaphor going on. There's some teaching, some lessons learned from what you're communicating.
Exactly. And I think that's what all those old songs are really about. When I think about what speaks to me in those old songs, especially this is something I did mostly working with spirituals. Obviously, there's a great deal of religious meaning there. I'm not a super religious person, but I think that there are a lot of lessons about our cultural values and who our ancestors wanted us to grow up to be encoded into those songs. And I think taking them and putting them in even a more different context than, you know, we are now from where they were when they wrote the songs,
right.
It helps us distance ourselves enough from, I think, the overt religious text that we can more easily understand the more subtle meanings.
But the subtle underbed is the human condition.
Yes.
Right? So the religious is kind of a metaphor or a thematic way to stitch it together.
Exactly.
When you study and listen and read, going back in time, they're talking to you.
Yes.
You know, and in what ways have you heard what they're trying to tell you in literal sense?
I think it can sometimes be hard. There's a little bit of invention that has to go on when you're part of any marginalized group, whether you're a queer person or a black person or a woman who's going back and trying to hear yourself in those old things, because the people who were making the music at that time were not empowered to speak openly about their own thoughts and beliefs.
So a lot of kind of cryptic messaging.
It's all in metaphor. And that means, you know, coming out of that, you know, my dad grew up on a farm in southeastern Virginia. I am close to that side of my family. Mm. You know, when we were going down to visit my grandparents, we'd drive past the neighbor's house, and my grandfather would say, "Your great, 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 great granddaddy sat under that tree when he was exercising his master's horses."
Wow.
That's how close we are to that.
Wow.
I feel close. I feel like I understand what's being said. Mm-hmm. But I think part of the reason why I feel comfortable delving into this Afrofuturist thing and doing so much imagining with my new work is because I've embraced how much imagining I have to do when I'm going back and imitating that stuff. And even on the concrete level of being a performer, learning off those old recordings, I'm imitating the technology as much as I'm imitating the people. I only know what they sound like through a reel-to-reel tape recorder or, you know, a wax cylinder at the outside.
Wow.
So
But in a perfect world, you're trying to go back in time, right?
Exactly. And I think one of the cool things about the new project has been being able to go forward and backward all at once and feel myself as part of a continuous tradition.
How powerful.
Yeah.
And so yourself as a musician, voice, instrument, you know, how do you communicate?
I think I'm working on that. And I think as the music evolves, I find the need to change a little bit. And when I've been going out presenting the like old school string band bluegrass music, for me, it's all been about kind of saying the names of the people that I learned the songs from, because so many of those were folks who were playing alongside and in some cases even teaching the white musicians who came down to Bristol and got famous in the early days, and they never got recorded because it was believed that black people playing that music couldn't be marketable. I've been wanting to give them the time that they did not have while they were still here, and that's always been a focus of mine. I think with this new work, it comes more from within me than anything else I've done, and I'm still figuring out how much of myself to insert.
Back in 1927, Bristol Sessions, they did Race Records. So obviously you studied and delved in there. What did you learn from that?
One of the fun things, not fun, but interesting things that I have come to understand from looking back into that history is we treat the race record, hillbilly record divide largely as this thing from the past, but we see it remade in so many ways, even in the new music that's coming out.
Really? And that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's at the root of our current genre classification system. I mean, the race and hillbilly record divide set the stage for the evolution of country and bluegrass as white genres, and blues and R&B and soul as black genres. Whereas before,
so what you're implying is segregation.
Exactly. In the moment when the race records and hillbilly records were being split, these were musicians who'd been playing alongside each other. They would have all played a little bit of each other's music. The traditions would have fed into one another all over the place. And the record industry in those early days created a financial incentive for black people to sound one way so their records would sell, and white people to sound one way so their records would sell. And even today, when we hear people like gatekeeping what country looks or sounds like, or what folk music looks or sound like, we're recreating this segregationist logic from 100 years ago. It plays out over and over again.
That's really powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Somehow in my mind, maybe I'm naive, but I think in my mind we're beyond that. But no.
Yeah, well, in some ways we are. You know, we've come to understand that it isn't right to group people based on race, and that, you know, we would never sell things as race records today.
Right.
And that is in and of itself a step. But at the same time, you know, there have been many journalists who've pointed out how black artists get pigeonholed at the Grammys into very specific categories. And that's just one example. In some ways, the genres that we've inherited have the same pattern to them, even if the labels have changed.
Let's go back in time in your life. You're a kid.
Yeah.
At what point did you kind of get it, music, both voice and instrument?
Man, I consider myself somewhat of a late bloomer compared to most of my peers. I play music with a lot of people who started, you know, when they were ages 4 through 10. And I started playing the electric guitar when I was 12, but I was terrible at it. And I didn't really get good at music until I was probably 17 years old. And I picked up an acoustic guitar, and then I went off to college and had my first banjo lessons, and that was the first thing I'd ever been good at.
Oh, funny.
So I took it and ran with it, and here I am today.
How funny. Did you ever play around with violin, fiddle?
I got one as a graduation present from high school, and it took me about a year to work up the courage to go to my, you know, college music department and be like, can I just take violin lessons? And went into the violin lessons and kind of told the guy, I don't really care about classical music, but I want to play the fiddle. Can you help me not hurt myself and sound okay? And he was like, this is interesting. I'm down.
Cool.
So I got a little bit of the exercises and the mechanical approach from that, but I've never been classically trained in a real way.
Can you play by ear?
Yes. Yeah. I can only play by ear. It's becoming a problem, actually.
So funny. So going forward, you have a group.
Yes.
And how many? Talk to us about who you are, you know, what you do.
Yeah. Well, I tour sometimes in a few different formats, just depending on the situation. But on this run and for most of the next several months, I will have a quartet with me, a fiddler named George Jackson from Nashville, a bassist named Nelson Williams from New Orleans, and a guitarist named Gus Tritch from State College, Pennsylvania. And
you know, all acoustic.
It's sometimes all acoustic, but as we're doing this new project, you know, this is the start of the release tour for the New Faith. So we're starting to mix in other stuff, and really, yeah, start to trouble the timeline in the ways that I'm trying to do in my work, where I'm playing this, like, you know, 5-string banjo with the goat skin head. And then we have Gus playing through, you know, this Vox amp, getting this real vintage guitar tone. And then I have like Ableton and MIDI controllers. Just doing all of the time periods at one time. It's all starting to melt together in a way that's really exciting for us.
It works.
Yeah, yeah. But we are doing some acoustic sets here and there. I don't think we're ever going to get tired of playing that stuff.
That's cool. And where are you touring these days?
Oh, man, we're going everywhere. We're doing kind of the southeast, the upper south, up to the Midwest on this run. We do the northeast in October. We do the west coast in November. And then in December, we're doing the deep south.
Cool. Where in the West Coast and Deep South?
The West Coast, really the whole thing. We're going from Seattle all the way to Los Angeles, I think.
Before we started recording, we talked about San Francisco and Oakland.
Right? Oh, yeah. I'll be there. Freight and Salvage. There? Yes, it's happening.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, so that'll be fun. Deep South, I think we're also doing a widespread. I think we're going, you know, starting somewhere up in these parts, headed down toward Florida, and then over to New Orleans. And I think that's where we're packing it in for the year. Get to see our family for the holidays.
Mm-hmm. Take a break.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's your day job.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I feel lucky to have made it work all this time. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's hard, and it's getting harder these days.
It is. And part of it is the industry.
Yes.
Battling against you to make money off of Spotify or whatever.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the Spotify thing is a problem, yes. Mm-hmm. I do think that there was a problem that it answered in the form of piracy, mm-hmm. that we now are dealing with much less because it's there. On the other hand, I think, you know, that's one, you know, we don't make revenue off of recorded music anymore. These days, because of the pandemic, a lot of the venues are on a shoestring budget and they can't pay us very much. A lot of the audience is on a shoestring budget because of inflation, mm-hmm. and they can't buy things. Everywhere we're supposed to get money from has no money right now. It's like a 3 steps removed problem. And, so, you know, airfares are through the roof. It's really hard to keep going right now.
So looking forward, is there any ideas, any hopes for monetizing and making the art of music viable?
I think that there is a way. For me, what that looks like is really investing in my local and regional community, mm-hmm. rather than focusing on these giant tours that cover the whole country. Maybe think about what we can do, really investing in local talent at home, whether we're talent buyers, whether we're artists who are trying to figure out who to share our platforms with or who to hire for our bands. Mm-hmm. Whether we have people near us that we can work with and that helps us financially, and that we don't have to worry about plane fare, we don't have to rent cars necessarily, mm-hmm. and it helps the environment. These problems are all connected to one another. I think that embracing our own local musical ecosystems that kept us fed for millennia before this recording industry we're all used to came into being, I think that's going to be ultimately the way forward. But you know, in the meantime, I think all the artists are just realizing we're going to have to be adaptable as far as ensemble size and mm-hmm. length of tour and everything like yeah. that.
Well, I like your idea of regional, local. There's so many elements that are win-win.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think we would see a groundswell of diversity in mm-hmm. music, both in the people sense and also the sound sense. I think that more people would feel like art was open to them as a participatory thing rather than just as a spectator.
Yep.
I would be excited to see us reinvest in that.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing you on stage.
Well, thanks yeah. for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. And only because they gave me 15 minutes with yeah. you. We're out of time.
Yeah.
But how cool. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm ready for a hug.
Yeah.
Okay, to learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
If you would like to go to my website, jakeblunt.com, B-L-O-U-N-T, I have all of my stuff on there, and I also have a big webpage called Black String Band Resources, where you can click through and find audio recordings, movies, books, articles, all sorts of things to read about the history of this tradition.
Jake, thank you so much.
Thanks Way for cool. having me.
My pleasure. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We'll see you here in Bristol, Tennessee, and Virginia.
Generation children. Oh, yes. Didn't it? You know, didn't it? Oh, my Lord, didn't it rain? Well, it rained 40 days. It rained 40 days.
Carry my prayers on the ocean, carry my prayers on the sea, and if you are meant to be mine, love, one day you'll come home to me. But are you a trick of...
Tom Wilmer, reporting from Bristol, Virginia.
This is Emily Scott Robinson.
I understand you're from Colorado.
So I'm originally from North Carolina, Piedmont in North Carolina, but I've been living in and around Colorado for a little over a decade.
So this is familiar territory for you.
It is, yeah. It's closer to my original home than to where I'm living now.
Tell us about what you do for your art. Voice, singing?
I'm a singer and songwriter. Play guitar, and mostly guitar, a little bit of piano.
Acoustic?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I did just buy an electric this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What drove you over the line?
Well, I was in the studio about a year and a half ago making my latest record, American Siren, and I had written this country song, and it sounded like a little bit darker on acoustic. Actually, my bass player said, hey, have you thought about playing electric on this song? And so we went into the closet and found an electric guitar, and I played electric, and that was really fun for me.
So it was an epiphanous moment for you?
Yeah, I mean, I had played electric. I mean, they're both guitars, but it just inspired me in a different way. Mm-hmm. It inspired a different type of singing from me, actually, and a different type of playing.
So. Interesting. You're a storyteller.
I am. Storyteller meets storyteller.
Yeah. Well, you're better than I am.
I don't know about that.
So tell us about, because you're melding the art of storytelling into song.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting dance.
I mean, I really think that that's actually the heart of country music and folk music, obviously, is storytelling. It's rooted in what it's like to be a human on this earth in this lifetime, you know? So I also just think that as a storyteller, there's no end to the songs that I can write because people are just infinitely interesting in their capacity to be beautiful and resilient and also crazy.
But there's undertone in some of the stuff you do that's trying to be therapeutic about painful, uncomfortable things.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of that is me finding my way through those experiences as I grow older. And absolutely.
So there's a personal healing, therapeutic value to what you do.
Definitely.
And
yeah.
And then you hit that string that resonates with everybody.
Yeah. And I think as a writer in the craft of writing, there are certain, especially when you get really physically grounded in the detail of an experience, right? If you're writing about a breakup, or you're writing about a lonely winter in living in a trailer park, there's just these visceral details that you provide that you don't have to tell people how to feel about that thing.
Mm-hmm.
You give them that scene, you take them into it, you put them in their bodies or in their memories, and they just, it's like, oof. In them, they feel it, you know. So I try to do that.
So there's that universal thread of humanity that resonates with others.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they wouldn't understand what you're talking about.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
The universality of detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
An English professor said, "The more accurately you describe yourself, the more obscure you become." You got to think about that one for a minute.
But oh, that's so interesting.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, if you say, I love you, everybody gets it. But if you and I were on a sunset over the Pacific Palisades and, oh, I love you like the sunset over the Palisades.
Yeah.
You know, you get it, but you lost that. So it's an interesting thread.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a balance to it, right? Because people also, you know, the phrase I love you is so generic. Mm-hmm. You know, we say it all the time. And so if you provide the setting or the scene, you help transport people. And people want to be entertained. They want to be transported. They want to be taken on a journey. So I think I, as a listener, would love to hear more about the Palisades scene.
Exactly, yeah.
It's
yeah.
more interesting, you know, even if I've never been there.
Yeah, and more contextually specific.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So on the painful side of your life, you had a cousin that killed themselves.
He died by suicide. He was an Army veteran. He had served two tours in Afghanistan. Yeah, I was close to him growing up. I'm really close to that, to all my cousins, really. And it was a really incredibly tragic death. And not only was it deeply personal to our family, but I realized that what we were going through personally, thousands of families were going through every year. Families of people who, anybody who's close to a veteran. And so that's what inspired the song Hometown Hero. That's the story of my cousin.
You should be here. We should be sitting by the fire on our second round of beers. We open the whiskey. We're out back in the shop. We're raising our glass to you. Still numb from the shock. 'Cause you're the only one who's missing. And it doesn't feel right. You should be tucking in your baby girl and kissing her goodnight. And your son is full of questions about how Daddy got to heaven. We never thought you'd go this way. You were only 27. Our hometown heroes in the news today. The flags are flying at half mast.
There was a therapeutic personal process for you.
I think.
To get the feelings, put them to words.
Well, I think more than anything, the power of that song is just telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I realized if I didn't paint the truth and I just wrote down what happened, you know, there's not a lot of editorial in that song. It's just the scenes, it's just the details. There's a few moments of reflection on what it means, but very little.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that that truth of that experience was so powerful, and there's so much quietness, there's so much hushing of that particular swath of suicides, and we're losing more veterans to suicide than we lose in combat.
It's in excess of 20 per week commit suicide.
It's a sign of a tremendous lack of support.
There's a disconnect there in the military or whatever that a lot of people, we can't quite figure out what that missing ingredient is, and that's lack of support.
I think so. I mean, I think also there are some things that are just very difficult to heal from. If you talk to anybody who's ever been in combat, there are certain wounds that I don't know that they would ever say they could heal through any amount of therapy. I will say I've met a tremendous number of veterans who are doing this work themselves because they're not getting the support from the government, the military, or the VA. They're organizing together to support themselves and other veterans in these really remarkably healing projects for veterans, and it's incredible.
I need to add my own editorial. Yeah. I was recently in Tampa, and I was involved with the Southeast Guide Dogs, and one of the heads of it on the board started a nonprofit called Paws for Patriots, where they match a doggie with a vet, a PTSD vet.
Wow.
And among that population, they have had a zero suicide rate.
Wow.
Every vet that's been matched with a doggie, none of them commit suicide.
That's wonderful.
I know, so we need more. pause for patriots.
Definitely. And I think also just that community, again, like, you're seeing that, like, veterans and the people who love them are providing the resources that the military and the VA are not providing. Like, you know, these huge monolithic organizations mm-hmm. aren't necessarily capable and are certainly in many cases unwilling and underfunded to provide the real human support that we need, that helps heal people, that helps keep them here with us.
Unfortunately, we both need to process.
Yeah.
But we need to get back on track about you and your musical world.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell us about where you're at, where you're going.
Well, let's see. It depends on when this is going to air.
Well, by the time it airs, this festival is going to be over.
Well,
but
then I can share this fun detail, which is on Monday I'll be announcing my next album, which is a song cycle of songs that I wrote for the Witches of Macbeth.
Wow.
Shakespeare's Macbeth. I wrote it for this theater piece, and so the witches actually performed in the show. Now, I do have to clarify, it's not Macbeth the musical. Mm-hmm. It is Macbeth the tragedy, with these three witches singing in three-part harmony in various portions through the show, sort of as like a Greek chorus, mm-hmm. But also in their own roles as witches. And that will be coming out October 28th. I'm one of the witches, and features two dear friends of mine, Alisa Amador, who actually just won NPR's Tiny Desk Contest this year. And so she is up-and-coming rising star, and then another dear friend of mine and musical collaborator. Her name is Lizzie Ross, and she's in a duo called Violet Bell. She and her partner Omar, who are the duo, are going to be my band for this weekend's set here at Bristol Rhythm and Roots. So
that's really cool.
They're going to play with me tomorrow. And anyways, be on the lookout for the album of witch songs. It's coming out before Halloween, and it's called Built on Bones.
And where would somebody find that?
They'll be able to find it online. So anywhere you listen to music, Spotify, Amazon, Apple, YouTube. We've got some very cool music videos that are going to be coming out for it. If you're a Shakespeare nerd or you just like spooky songs, witchy songs, it was a lot of fun to work with the archetypes within Shakespeare and within Macbeth. Mm-hmm. Greed and power and desire and grief and and tragedy and magic and the question of power, really. Who holds the locus of power in various points in the play? It was so much fun to make.
That's really cool. And again, Google search.
Well, you could go to my website, EmilyScottRobinson.com.
One more time.
EmilyScottRobinson.com. Mm-hmm. Or you can go to Oh Boy Records, which is my record label. That's John Prine's record label. That's OhBoy.com. And you can find it there.
That's really cool. So a little bit more about your music and what you do kind of week in, week out, in your normal world when you're not on stage.
You know, I don't know that I have a normal world, Tom. You know, because week in, week out, it's like, 10 days ago I was down in Texas playing an outdoor show, trying to keep my guitar in tune. Now I'm here in Bristol. And between that, I was home in Colorado. But when I'm home, I'm generally writing and hiking in the mountains and mountain biking and cooking meals for myself and doing all the back end work is a part of being a musician.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So looking forward, what's on your list of live venues that you upcoming this fall and winter?
Well, I am playing a couple of special shows this fall. We're going to do a special release show for this Built on Bones project, for the Witches project in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm really excited about that. And I'm playing Sisters Folk Festival out in Oregon. But mostly, I'm taking a break from touring for the rest of the fall and going to be going out on tour next February and March with Alisa and Lizzie to sing the songs from the new Built on Bones record out on tour. So those tour dates will be announced soon. You can find them on my website.
So when you take your interlude break coming up, are you just going to be open-ended and do whatever comes along?
Well, mostly I'll be recovering. Just because touring the way I have done it in the past year, you know, I'm releasing, this will be 2 albums in 1 year.
Wow.
So it's been a little nuts. I've been traveling a ton this year, and I need a bit of a break. So it'll mostly just be getting healthy. And by that, I mean just like cooking for myself, nesting, being at home, sleeping 8 hours a night, going to bed at a reasonable hour instead of getting to a hotel at 1 a.m. Yeah. So writing, yeah.
You've heard about people that get to sleep in?
Oh, yeah.
Has that ever happened?
You know, it's funny. It depends on the day. It depends on the touring day for me, right? So when I'm at home off of tour, I can sleep as late as I want, which is very nice. But I live in a very sunny spot. So the sun, the tyranny of the sun in the Colorado mountains is pretty significant.
And you're at a high altitude.
I am. Yeah. I'm at almost 9,000 feet, which is great at sea level and a real pain when I go back up.
You feel it, huh?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Absolutely. It always takes me a couple days to get used to it again.
But that's why they train Olympic athletes in Mexico City.
It's true. Yeah, Mexico City is very high in altitude.
Yeah, it's getting up there.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I could keep you all day, but I know you've got
to.
Yeah, perform. What an honor to meet you.
Thank you. It's so good to meet you, too.
My pleasure. Yeah. Okay, one more time to learn more about your world. Where would you direct somebody?
So go to my website, EmilyScottRobinson.com.
I'm S.G. Goodman. I'm a singer-songwriter out of Western Kentucky. Pleasure to be here with you.
My honor. Let's go back in time.
All right.
You grew up in Kentucky?
I did. I was raised in Kentucky. I was born right across the line in Tennessee in Obion County. And my dad's a farmer in Western Kentucky, and he still farms in Tennessee, actually. But my home address has always been in Kentucky.
It's your heart, too, huh?
It is, yeah. I mean, I have a very sweet spot for Western Tennessee, too, obviously. And because it was the closest, largest town, you know, had the place where we would do our shopping and stuff. I mean, I feel just as much indebted to that area, too.
Well, your area, it's kind of like going across the border. You don't know, like, are we in Virginia now or Tennessee?
Exactly.
I'm not sure.
I don't know either, because driving through here in my van, my GPS systems would say, welcome to Virginia a lot, and I'd just be, you know, taking a corner.
Yeah, exactly. So, SG.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Well, it's just initials for my name. For the music thing, I think that makes the most sense. You know, my birth name is Shayna, and a lot of people have a hard time pronouncing it and a hard time spelling it. So I just made it simple for everybody.
Reduce and simplify. I love it. As a kid, was music in your family, in your home?
I think it was in my family in a pretty typical way for that community. Every home seemed to have a piano. I think that kind of harkened back to a time when that was used for home entertainment. Families gather around, sing together. And my dad's a farmer, and so, you know, Hickman, Kentucky specifically, the town I was raised in, is less than 3,000 people, and it's a very rural place. So we'd spend a lot of time in farm equipment and trucks, driving around, looking at land, checking on the crops, and music was always in the background, at least. And I'd say I mostly got to know music through being raised in the church there.
So you were in choir?
I had to be. Yeah, I was. Mm-hmm. But, I, you know, I don't have a formal education in music, and I always tell people that that's where I learned as much as they know. Just from watching other people and hearing the parts sing and, you know, being so familiar with the hymnal.
Do you envision and create a song and lyrics, literally, like you alluded to, driving around and tractors in the background or whatever?
Absolutely, a couple of things. One, if I record anything, I always take it down the back roads and play it out.
Really?
See how it feels. Yeah.
Kind of field test it.
Yep, exactly. See how the, you know, land acts towards it. But I, you know, was raised farmer's daughter, spent most of my childhood outside doing manual labor, and even though I technically don't have to do that right now, I choose to. It's there's something meditative about working with your hands and being able to do something, not necessarily mindless, but something that allows your creativity to come out while you're doing something productive.
Yeah, no, I know. I've been doing it all my life. You know, and you have to kill me to stop doing that.
I feel the same way. Yeah. I miss it so much, and being out on the road so much lately, I've really had a hankering for trying to get back out and do some work. I miss it.
I totally understand, because for me, it's that therapeutic mental cleansing. So I imagine that going to the what people think is mindless is therapeutic and gives you that clarity. That's probably where the visions come, right?
So much of it, I would say yes. I love people, and I am a people person, but I'm not an extrovert. So I think being out alone with some dirt and a task kind of allows me to ground myself and definitely aids in the creative process.
A fascinating paradox. You know, here's this classic introvert that loves being out in the field, right? But somehow there's this other side and this other need that allows you to go on stage and not be petrified.
You know, and that was many years in the making, I would say. I would not claim to anybody that I've learned the art of performing. I think that's going to be an ever ongoing process. But I do find a lot of joy into seeing people connect with what music came to me while I was, you know, working on a farm or out in the woods. That's kind of special, and just a way that I feel like I've been, I don't know, for lack of better words, called to give back or contribute.
As a kid growing up, what music first resonated with you? You know, what artist that you first started to follow and wanted to emulate?
I mean, you know, I was a kid in the 90s, so a lot of the early kind of girl singer, Sheryl Crow, like Alanis Morissette, these powerful women that really kind of just reigned supreme at a certain time in music. I thought that that was pretty cool. But I was raised on old country. And so, you know, Patsy Cline, I love Etta James, I love Irma Thomas, I love these powerhouse women that sing like it's, you know, their only purpose in the world to share their voice. I've just always really connected with certain voices that seem like it's coming from somewhere outside of themselves. So I've always gravitated to that kind of music.
When you write lyrics, are you writing for yourself, basically?
I think that's always a, you know, just maybe depends on the circumstance. Sometimes you don't realize that you wrote that for yourself later, and I think your brain is playing a little trick on you so that you can write it. Some things are very personal. Some things, you know, you might be writing out like a heartbreak song before the heartbreak has come. So you don't want to think of yourself as like a fortune teller, but maybe you were.
So you look back and you're going, whoa.
I know something, you know, your heart could feel it, but your mind wasn't ready to see it for what it was, that kind of thing. So I'd say it just depends on the circumstance, and no matter what, the method is of getting there, just let the process speak for itself, you know.
That's really powerful.
Thank you.
And was an instrument, a guitar, whatever, always a part of you?
No, I actually picked up the, I was a ball player growing up, and my mother was a excellent ball player growing up. Back when there wasn't like a three-point line, my mother has, you know, back in our home county where we both went to school, she's like an all-time high scorer with just a two-point system, you know. And so she wanted me to play ball, and I broke her heart about when I was 15. Say, I want to quit playing ball. I want to start learning how to play the guitar.
Oh, interesting.
I did take some piano lessons early on as a child, but we kind of had an old school teacher there in my town who would, you know, you would have formal recitals where you'd curtsy and dress up, and I just wasn't that wasn't for me.
Yeah. And how about other instruments? Do you ever pick up violin or mandolin? No.
I mean, I've picked up a lot of instruments, and I don't even consider myself, you know, I get by with what I know how to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd never claim to be a guitar expert or anything mm-hmm. like that.
So your guitar playing is almost to accompany you as a singer, right?
It is. My one instrument that I would say, you know, that I can stand next to any instrumentalist is my voice, and that's what I have, you know, learned to just kind of elevate that with my playing. I don't think I'll live long enough to be able to be a lead guitar player or whatever, mm-hmm. but that's all right. We're not meant to do all things,
and
you know.
And it's acoustic.
No, I play an electric guitar.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Why do you prefer electric?
Well, I think you can feel it differently. I play an old Guild Starfire 4. I also play a Gibson 335 now. It's a newer one, but my Guild is my baby, and I really play the Gibson just to give it a break and maybe not put it in as dangerous of situations. But I like the neck. I love the way those old humbuckers sound in it, and I just think I tune everything down a whole step when I play, which is everybody's nightmare, including my own. You can't keep something in tune that way. The guitars really weren't built for that, but I think my voice sits over that nicely.
That's really cool.
And so that's what I do. Mm-hmm.
And when you're on the road performing, do you have people that are playing with you? Is it solo?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm in a rock outfit.
Okay.
So right now I'm a four-piece, and that's more economical than getting the whole ensemble up there. Maybe one day, you know, mm-hmm. get some record sales or something. I can come out and put on a big old show. But right now, with my van, and I like the boys I'm running around with. Mm-hmm. So, no, it's a full rock show.
That's mm-hmm. cool.
Yeah.
And I know that a lot of musicians are struggling financially just because of the way the world works,
mm-hmm.
you know, people downloading music and not buying it and whatnot.
Yeah.
That's a tough one, isn't it?
It's very tough, and, you know, most record deals are still not built around that system.
Mm-hmm.
Units being sold, which means if you're spinning my tune on Spotify, you'd have to do that 150 times before that would equate to a sold unit.
Wow.
So you could see the uphill battle that is for an artist, especially an up-and-coming artist, which is what I'm probably referred to a lot of times. It's really important for people, and I know so many people support artists and want to do everything they can, and I always say the best way is to buy their record.
That's what I was going to ask. In a perfect world, how would you craft it? How would you create it so it would be financially remunerative?
Well, either, you know, I guess Congress would have to act to make streaming sites pay the artist, mm-hmm. you know.
Think that can and will happen?
I'm not sure. There's obviously some really big fish to fry right now in mm-hmm. the world, you know. I would like to see, you know, our government and companies realize, you know, the importance of art and respect the artists enough to, you know, give them what they deserve out of that. But as we know, a lot of times politicians, they are looking for the thing to keep them in office and not necessarily always do the work that people need. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Perfect world. It seems like in the here and now that going on the road and doing live performances would be one of the most remunerative as a musician.
Possibly. There's a lot to that. You know, it depends on what size you are. And
right.
everybody, we're still coming out of a pandemic. You know, festivals have been hit hard.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the people, the old school folks who've been running festivals for years have not come back. So you have new hands and things can be a little shaky sometimes when you go out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm so glad and humbled that people still want to enjoy live music and support artists that way. I'm glad technology hasn't totally replaced that. So I think there's a lot of hope for things to kind of rebalance themselves. And, you know, music isn't going away. And it appears that people who want to see it play live, it hasn't gone away yet either.
Yeah. Well, I think for a lot of people, there's something therapeutic about it, right?
Yeah, 100%. You know, when you go to a concert and you're seeing the human side of music being played. You know, I'm not a perfect performer, mm-hmm. and I never will be, and I won't ever present myself that way. I hope people enjoy as much as I do me turning around and getting a laugh out of my drummer, or, you know, maybe fumbling something, and seeing the human element, I think, is what's always so exciting about watching live performances. It's you're in a vulnerable state with the audience, and I think they can feel that, and that's why I think it's addictive for so many people.
I know myself, as my time as a storyteller on stage, that even though it's a group, say at 500, mm-hmm. that I'll dial in and look at one person in the eye. You're ultimately talking to or singing for one person, even though you're on stage. Does that a part of your brain thinking when you're up there?
You know, at the stage I am, I still go down to my merch table a lot. Mm-hmm. So I get to hear firsthand who was connected with that night.
But when you're on stage, when you're performing, mm-hmm. you know, are you augering in and looking?
Sometimes. At,
yeah.
If the stage allows for that, mm-hmm. I do. But, you know, I got a lot of things going on at once up there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can get sidetracked real easily.
Sure.
So I'm just trying to keep the ship afloat, mostly.
I understand. but what's interesting is me, as somebody in your audience, mm-hmm. I'm a solo person listening to a solo person.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're hitting it out of the ballpark, you're resonating with my heart and soul as mm-hmm. an individual. And I just wonder if you retain that awareness that even though you're performing for a group, at the same time you're performing for one person in the audience. You understand?
I do. That's what's powerful about it, right?
It
the
is.
Impact you can have on individuals.
Yes.
I know artists have had impact on me. And so that definitely is, you know, something that's in my mind when I'm performing, and mm-hmm. also that makes me want to do the best I can.
Yeah. Paradox, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And you forget sometimes that, in a sense, people metaphorically, they have an ownership in you. They feel like a kinship and they're friends with you, even though they've never met you.
Exactly. Yeah. There's some social stuff going on a lot of times with musicians and different people. But at the same time, I think I've made it a point and will continue to make it a point to approach things in an authentic nature. And even though sometimes it is a little strange to connect with a lot of people through that, I think that's going to be the most powerful. And I think the world needs a lot more authenticity out there.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people gravitate towards what I do.
Are you hankering to get back on a tractor and get on the back 40 and refresh your soul?
Well, I've been working for a gentleman back in Callaway County, and I'm not on a tractor out there. I'm tending the garden and doing some, like, erosion work around his woods. I haven't been home in a long time, and I'd love to be with my dog mm-hmm. and my cat for a minute. I'm really needing some my family time, which awesome. Is my dog and cat.
I love it, yeah. The special souls.
Absolutely, those little beings you get to walk around with for a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I could keep you all day, but we've exceeded our allotted time.
Well, I appreciate it. It was great talk. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure and honor. And one last, you had to have a theme song. It's your movie. In the opening credits, what music cut would you choose for your movie?
Well, now that I'm on the road so much, I'd probably say Roll On 18-Wheeler by Alabama, because I feel like a truck driver. Currently, in mm-hmm. this moment, I'm definitely just thinking of the highway.
I love it. SG, thank you so much.
Thank you.
What
appreciate
a pleasure. It. Yeah. To learn more about your world, where would you direct the listener?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the name of the game now is follow on social media. I interact mostly with TikTok and Instagram these days. But if you'd like to support me and my music and you'd like to get my record, you can go to sggoodman.net and find that there and find all my tour dates.
Awesome. SG, thank you again.
Thank you.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Bristol, Tennessee, and Virginia. We'll see you here.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. Hello.